Talk Shoe. Recorded live.
And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities. Fellow Adamites, we are seeing the cracks emerge in Babylon. We are seeing the cracks spread. I don't believe it will be too long now before we hear Babylon the Great is fallen. And Yahweh willing, we shall all witness it, and all the world shall bear witness to the power of Yahweh. If you have not begun to prepare for the things which are to come, the things which you are already starting to see happen, then you'd best do so now. Now is the time to make preparations, gather supplies, make plans, and focus your efforts to keep on the straight and narrow path. Be right with the Heavenly Father, and He shall bring you through the plagues that await this doomed nation. Today is January 23rd, 2011, Sunday, and Bill Fink and Kaiser are joining us for this installment of Hitler and Operation Barbarossa, the invasion of the Soviet Union. How are you gentlemen doing tonight?
Hello, praise Yahweh.
Absolutely, and maybe we could properly call it the preemptive invasion of the Soviet Union, since we've already demonstrated that the Soviets were amassing a great number of troops directly on the Soviet-German border.
Well, absolutely, and tonight I have some information from Viktor Suvorov, the Russian historian, that's going to complement this speech, I hope, and also show how far in advance Stalin planned this. And it'll also show a lot of the differences between the government, the practices in government between the Germans and Hitler and the Russians and Stalin, or the Soviets, I should say, and Stalin.
I think they planned this as far in advance as 1918 when they signed the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, since Lenin basically said and Trotsky said that it didn't matter how much land they had to cede to the Germans since they were going to rule Europe.
Well, it was probably planned when the Bank of England was founded, or at least when the Rothschilds took it over, right?
Certainly.
That they would control all of the world's money.
But we've always heard that the Germans have made these claims, oh, we're going to rule the world. The Kaiser said, woe to my enemies, they will be destroyed. Hitler said, today we rule Germany, tomorrow the world. Yet no one can ever cite those quotes. They can never properly cite their sources. Yet we have Lenin openly talking about how the revolution will be spread across Europe, and how every European country will become a Soviet republic.
Well, right. Tonight we'll find from Suvorov that Stalin operated like a mafia don and kept all his plans secret and recorded nothing of his meetings, and Hitler had three stenographers and a recorder everywhere he went.
He must have been trying to hide something, Hitler.
Yeah,
otherwise
he'd have
had more stenographers.
And he must have been.
Why would old Uncle Joe need to record his meetings? He was trustworthy, an American ally.
Of course. All right. Yeah, are you going to read this speech, this
Berlin, October 3rd, 1941.
Well, this speech is Adolf Hitler speaking at a sports palace, right, at a stadium on the opening of the Kriegswinterhilfswerk, which is the winter war relief. It was a war relief campaign that he was trying to encourage the people to, I believe, help out with supplying the army, it seems like. And I don't know. That's what the word seems to mean to me.
German men and women, if I speak today again after many long months to you, it is not to reply to one of those statesmen who recently wondered why I had been silent for such a long time. Posterity will one day be able to weigh up which was more important in the past 3.5 months, the speeches of Churchill or my actions. I have come here today to deliver a short introductory address on the winter help scheme. This time, it was particularly difficult for me to come here because in the hours in which I can be here, a new gigantic event is taking place on our Eastern Front. For the last 48 hours, an operation of gigantic proportions is again in progress, which will help to smash the enemy in the East. I am talking to you on behalf of millions who are at this moment fighting and want to ask the German people at home to take upon themselves, in addition to other sacrifices, that of winter help this year. Since the 22nd of June, a battle of decisive importance for the world has been taking place. Only posterity will clearly see its dimensions and depth and will realize that it marked a new era. Sadly, it marked an era that is the wrong era. An era of wickedness and evil and Jewish domination of the world. I don't think Hitler could envision that the Americans were going to plunge a dagger into his back while he was off trying to destroy communism.
Well, somebody should have explained Revelation 17:17 to him, but I'm sure nobody was in a position at the time, right?
I did not want this struggle. Since January 1933, when Providence entrusted me with the leadership of the German Reich, I had an aim before my eyes which was essentially incorporated in the program of our National Socialist Party. I have never been disloyal to this aim and have never abandoned my program. I made efforts to bring about the construction of a people who, after a war lost through its own fault, had experienced the deepest collapse in its history. This in itself was a gigantic task, and I began this task at a moment when others had failed in it or no longer believed in the possibility of ever accomplishing such a task. What we achieved in these years in the way of peaceful reconstruction is unparalleled, whereas the Americans and British basically had to be whores for the Jews to get out from under the so-called Great Depression, which was absolutely artificial and brought about by design. It is for me and my collaborators an offense to be compelled to have dealings with those democratic entities who are not in a position to look back even upon one single true great work in their lives. I and all of us did not need this war to perpetuate our names. Moreover, we were not at the end of our achievements, but in some fields still at the beginning. We succeeded in internally restoring our Reich, although under difficult conditions, for in Germany, 140 people per square kilometer have to be fed, yet we have solved our problems while others foundered on the problem. We had the following principles. First, the internal consolidation of the German nation. Second, the attainment of equal rights externally, and I assume he means for the Volksdeutsch, such as those in the Sudetenland and those in the Danzig corridor, who incidentally were being massacred, weren't they?
Absolutely. 59,000 people of them died in 1938 at the hands of the Poles.
And the Soviets had air bases in Czechoslovakia, didn't they?
Well, this planned Soviet takeover of Europe, that started when Lenin and Trotsky seized power in Russia.
Absolutely. Third, the unity of the German people, and thus the restoration of natural conditions which had been interrupted only artificially. And we're seeing that in this country too, aren't we, that the natural progress or the natural process of the development of our nation has been artificially interrupted by these Jewish interlopers. Were it not for them, we wouldn't have this so-called recession, depression, whatever you want to call it. Our nation would be functioning and reasonably healthy. Although we don't have a Hitler figure, and we never really did.
No, the last Hitler figure was Andrew Jackson. He killed the bank.
And they tried to kill him.
He threw the Jews out. He threw the Jews out of the hen house.
And they vilify him today as a racist slave owner.
Absolutely.
Back then they took a shot at him.
And a hater of Indians.
Although wasn't one of his adopted children an Indian?
Well, that's funny, because even the Negroes know that it's Jewish shipping merchants that had brought all the black slaves over here.
Our external program, therefore, was laid down in advance. This did not mean that we would ever strive for war, but one thing was certain, that we would in no circumstances renounce the restoration of German freedom and thus one of the conditions of German revival. I have submitted to the world many proposals along these lines. I need not repeat them here. This is done by my publicist collaborators. How many peace offers have I made to the world and disarmament proposals for a peaceful, new, sound world economic order? All these were rejected by those who could not hope that such peaceful work would keep their regime at the helm. Of course, the Soviets don't want to work peacefully because they know they can never come to power in other countries through democratic means. Soviet communism has to be forced on the masses. And Stalin was ready to do that, wasn't he? As we will prove in this program. In spite of that, we gradually succeeded through long years of peaceful work in carrying through not only great internal reforms, but also the unity of the German nation in creating the German Reich and in bringing back millions of Germans to their homeland. During this period, I succeeded in gaining a number of allies. These were headed by Italy, with whose statesmen I am linked by ties of personal and cordial friendship. Our relations with Japan continue to improve. In Europe, too, there were a number of nations and states which maintained their old friendships and sympathies, in particular Hungary and some Nordic states. New nations have been added to a number of these. Unfortunately, there is not among them the nation I wooed most strongly, Britain. The British people as a whole do not bear the sole responsibility. On the contrary, there are a few people who, in their deep hatred, in their senselessness, sabotage every attempt at such an understanding supported by that enemy of the world whom you all know, international Jewry. We did not succeed in bringing about such a link between Great Britain, especially the English people, with the German people, as I had always hoped for. Just as in 1914, the moment came when a hard decision had to be taken, I did not shrink from it, for I realized one thing, that if it were impossible to gain the friendship of England, it would be better if Germany experienced her enmity at a time when I was still a leader of Germany. If the friendship of England could not be won by the measures I had taken and the advances I had made, then it could never be won in the future. There was no other choice then but to fight. I am grateful to fate that I may lead this fight. I am convinced that no understanding can be reached with these men. They are mad fools, men who for 10 years had not spoken another word but, "We want another war with Germany." When I endeavored to bring about an understanding, Churchill cried, "I want war." Isn't that absolutely what the British did? They British Jewry declared war on Germany in 1933.
Well, absolutely. And you know, I have some notes here. I have a I just found this today, right? I have a I'd like to discuss a German propaganda poster called the Parole der Wache, W-O-C-H-E. I probably can't pronounce it right? Well, which was a weekly Nazi propaganda poster that was issued from 1936 to 1943. And the primary form of this poster was a wall newspaper. And I have about 180 or 190 examples of this, and they all came from a site in Denmark that I guess somebody has been collecting them. And I'd like to get them translated, and maybe I might try to see to that on my next Euro forum, right, my European fellowship forum. I'd like probably somebody to translate these at their convenience. Well, anyway, that they also issued smaller playing card size versions of these posters, which could be pasted on envelopes and things. And here's a translation of one of two of the examples of a certain poster concern a propaganda poster concerning England, which is posted at calvin.edu, and I'll read it here. The translation is supplied by scholars at Calvin. The German propaganda archive at Calvin is a good place for information about German propaganda. Stalin's ambassador, this is from the poster, right? This is a World War II propaganda poster in Germany. Stalin's ambassador for the Bolshevization of England, Safford Cripps, recently gave a speech in Bristol in which the warmonger said, quote, "There is no doubt that the Soviet Union will be the greatest European power if England and the United States win the war." So, and that's exactly what happened, right? "Since the war will probably end with the seat of government in Berlin. If the British do not have friendly relations with the Soviets, the Soviet Union will determine Europe's future alone." This is an Englishman saying this. "That it is clear proof that Churchill and Roosevelt have given the mass murderer Stalin a free hand in Europe in the event that they win with his assistance." In other words, they sold their souls to the devil, right? That this is from the German propaganda poster now. It's not from Cripps anymore. Besides that revelation of the infamous British-American war aims, the talkative Cripps said the following with cynical shamelessness, quote, "Stalin signed the 1939 treaty with Germany, but immediately began production to prepare for the moment in which he could successfully attack Germany." And I'll show that from Suvorov a little later in this presentation, right? That this statement by one who should know, he was the ambassador to the USSR from England, proves Stalin's treacherousness. Mr. Cripps' comments further proved to the whole world that the Führer had to strike at the last moment to save Germany and all of Europe from destruction by the Bolshevist hordes. Germany and the awakened peoples of Europe know what is necessary in this battle against the plutocratic Jewish conspiracy and its Jewish Bolshevik executioners. In other words, Hitler fully understood, and we've demonstrated this from Mein Kampf before, right? Hitler fully understood that the Jewish capitalists were in bed with the Jewish Bolsheviks, and the capitalists were really pulling the strings, right?
Absolutely. That's why the Bolsheviks never attacked the financiers.
Exactly. We've never seen a Bolshevik attack a bank, have we? Or
rob a bank. They may rob a bank or a train.
Mercantile exchange. How about a mercantile exchange? How about a stock office? How about Morgan Stanley or Chase Manhattan or one of those buildings?
They never assassinate speculators, commodity brokers. They kidnap grocery store owners and small businessmen, though.
Absolutely. The admission of an insider, I'm still reading from this propaganda poster. These posters were pretty, that they looked like Skip Baker artwork, right? They were pretty busy, that they had a lot of text. They were like a poster that served as a newspaper. Churchill's former ambassador in Moscow, Lord Privy Seal Cripps, recently stated, quote, Stalin signed a 1939 treaty with Germany, but immediately began production to prepare for the moment in which he could successfully attack Germany. Now this Cripps, I have a paragraph on him, and it's pretty frank. It's from Wikipedia, but it's still not too bad, and it basically comes out and gives us enough information to make up our minds about Mr. Cripps. Sir Richard Stafford Cripps was a British labor politician of the first half of the 20th century. In spite of a privileged background, how many of these rich aristocratic types do we see go communist, right? Go Marxist.
Well, a few in of them are limousine liberals.
Well, exactly. In spite of a privileged background, he was a longtime supporter of socialism and the rights of the working people. During World War II, he served in a number of positions under the Churchill-led National Coalition, including Minister of Aircraft Production. After the war, he was a member of the Attlee Labor government, serving as Chancellor of the Exchequer from 1947 to 1950. That's sort of like our Treasury Secretary, right? In which post he supported nationalization of heavy industry. There you have it. The man's a Marxist, right?
And what are all these supposedly anarchist? They want a stateless, classless society. They probably should hate the system. What are they doing? They become the system.
Right.
They rant against the man, and their main gripe is that they want to be the man.
And we see that today in our own government. He may be best remembered for his service as ambassador to the Soviet Union from 1940 to 42, while Adolf Hitler calls him Stalin's minister for the Bolshevization of Britain, right? A period that included both the Soviet's alliance with Hitler and the first shock of the German Blitzkrieg against the Soviet Union, as if they didn't have it coming. So it's evident to me that just as the Roosevelt administration was full of communist sympathizers, Jews, and liberal do-goodies, we would probably also find a lot of those in the British government of the time. And in fact, it can probably be ascertained that Wall Street money was and still is behind all of the causes of world Bolshevism, which is why we are also in the predicament which we are in today. As we demonstrated here a few weeks ago, Hitler full well knew that global capitalism and international Marxism are two arms of the same beast working towards the very same goal.
Well, look at Jacob Schiff of Kuhn Loeb Company. They financed the Japanese military buildup, helped industrialize and modernize Japan. They basically bankrolled their naval acquisitions, and their ships were built in British shipyards, by the way, so they could build up for a war against Russia. It weakened Russia in 1904, 1905 with the Russo-Japanese War, led the way for the 1905 revolution that was fortunately put down. And then, of course, they financed the Bolshevik Revolution later in 1917.
Yeah, yes, they did. That was a Jewish war against the Tsars of Russia that lasted. It probably started in the 1870s, right, at least.
Absolutely.
And I'm sure it goes back further than that.
They were testing the waters in 1905. Russia wasn't weak enough yet. World War I really weakened the Tsar's grip on power.
Well, yeah. So, let me just say about the Russo-Japanese War. The Russian Pacific Fleet. Now, that I've read that the Trans-Siberian Railway was sabotaged, that was bringing supplies to the Russian fleet there, and which is why they lost the battles with the Japanese.
Hmm.
Well, I haven't studied the Russo-Japanese War at any depth, but I wouldn't doubt it for 1 minute. It sounds very plausible. Why wouldn't the Jews have the rail line sabotaged? if they were banking on the winner, right?
I'd like to find out the name of the person who sabotaged it. Okay, it says here that a Polish insurgent, Józef Pilsudski, went to Japan and helped collaborate for sabotaging the railway, it looks like. That had to be a Jew from Poland. There's no doubt in my mind that the Jews were behind the sabotaging of that railway.
Well, you know, and if without supplies, you can't run a war. And if the
Absolutely.
If they don't have oil, they don't have ammunition, they can't fight.
Well, of course, and that's why the Jewish bosses of the munition factories in World War I Germany laid down.
I forget who it was. It might have been Caesar or Alexander the Great, who said that if you want to be a hero or a warrior, study swordsmanship. If you want to be a general, study tactics. And if you want to be a conqueror, study logistics. It's basically, if you're looking to build an empire, you need to have logistics down. If you want to decisively defeat your enemies, logistics are probably one of the most important things. And the Jews...
Well, if you study the Roman Wars of Conquest, the Punic Wars, the Gallic Wars, logistics was definitely what assisted them in their conquest of the Mediterranean world.
And the Jews have sabotaged the logistical efforts of most campaigns in the last several hundred years when they have the opportunity to do so. I think it's not for nothing in World War II that Erhard Milch, the head of German fighter production, was a Jew, and Germany never seemed to be able to get enough fighters in the sky. I don't think that's a coincidence. All right, then. He has got it now in regards to Churchill crying, "I want war." He has got it now. And all his co-warmongers who say that this will be a charming war, who congratulated each other on September 1st, 1939, on this coming charming war, may now perhaps think differently about this charming war. And should they not know yet that this war is no charming affair for England, they will surely become aware of it in due course. As truly as I am here, these warmongers succeeded in pushing Poland forward. These warmongers, not only of the old world, but also of the new world. And they just sacrificed Poland up and basically at the altar, didn't they? At the altar of international communism.
Well, absolutely, because they knew long ahead of time that they were going to turn it all over to the Soviets.
That was the time
the Jews in Britain wanted to consolidate Europe under a Jewish Soviet government. I have no doubt.
We covered that in Weeby, how they were looking to bring the Soviets in to put down the Hungarians, the Bulgarians, the Romanians for all the anti-Jewish measures that they'd taken to crack down on usury in the 20s.
Absolutely.
That was the time when England did not go about begging others for help, but still magnanimously promised help to everyone. This has since changed. In those days, I made proposals to Poland. Now that events have taken a course different from the one we wished, I must say that it was indeed Providence that prevented the acceptance of my offer at that time. This conspiracy of democratic Jews and Freemasons dragged Europe into war 2 years ago. Arms had to decide. Since then, a struggle has been taking place between truth and lies. And as always, this war will end in the victory of truth. In other words, whatever lies British propaganda, international world Jewry, and its democratic accomplices may concoct, they will not change historical facts. And it is a historical fact that for 2 years now, Germany has been defeating one opponent after another. Sadly, though, since they write the history books, they have changed historical facts. Well, they
Absolutely.
Haven't changed the actual reality, but they've changed our access to that reality.
You know, when I was a child, it's clear to me now from literature that I read, from adult literature that I read it about the Bolshevik rule in Russia in the time of Lenin, Trotsky, Stalin. It's very clear to me now that our government and mainstream academia certainly knew right from the time it happened about all of the mass murders, the mass starvations, the use of food as a weapon in Bolshevik Russia. And I never learned in grammar school or high school about any of that. We learned about World War II on the surface and about the how Stalin was our ally and Uncle Joe, and you get that they try to push that warm and fuzzy image of a kindly old man running this great big huge country in the East, right? The USSR. But they don't tell anybody the truth. They don't tell the average American who only goes to school for 12 years anywhere near the truth about world history.
Well, you never learn that the Bolshevik government was built upon the corpses of 40 million to 50 million people they massacred.
And Roosevelt and Churchill knew that this was a criminal regime that had taken over a Christian nation and a giant that was a giant empire at the same time, and used it for criminal purposes and slaughtered tens of millions of Christians.
Absolutely. And all these American children are taught that the Soviet Union was a great country. They had socialism. People were taken care of and provided for. And it's a shame the Soviet Union fell, because the evil Americans taxed their own people to death to outspend them with military buildup.
Well, the Soviet Union really never fell. It's like Rome really never fell. It came back as the Pope. Now it's back as we've become like the Soviet Union.
Sure.
So is Europe. The wall was not necessary anymore.
All those commissars have come here now, and they're teaching in academia.
Well, we've seen and lately, and I'm going to post this soon on the Mein Kampf website, that Trotsky's granddaughter is a drug czar here in the United States now. She's in charge of a major United States drug agency, government agency, and it's a drug oversight. Yeah, you know, the I forget the exact name of the agency, but this is Trotsky's
National Institute on Drug Abuse.
Yeah, yes, Trotsky's great granddaughter. Now, her father is still a huge promoter of Trotsky and of Bolshevism. His daughter is the head of a U.S. agency, and she was appointed by a Republican. She was appointed in 2003.
It doesn't make any sense.
So they're all in the same club, right? They're all in the same boat. They all punch the same – get the same tickets punched into the same restaurants and resorts, right? And they all hang out together. They're all in bed together.
Her wiki article page makes no mention of her Jewishness. It just says
capitalist American Jew, Russian Bolshevik Jew, Polish Jew, that they're all the same. And they're running the whole world. There's no doubt.
Her name is Nora Volkow.
Yes.
Ridiculous. They should have made her the head of Homeland Security.
Well, I don't know. That might be next. That might be next. Bring out the guillotines. Whenever you see Satan in charge, you see guillotines roll. All right, I'll let you continue with this.
I did not want it. Immediately after the first conflict, I again held out my hand. I have been a soldier myself, and I know how difficult it is to win a victory. My hand was rejected, and since then, we have seen that each peace offer was immediately exploited by the warmonger Churchill and his confers, so that they could say it was proof of our weakness. I have, therefore, given up trying this way. I have laboriously reached this conclusion. A clear decision must be fought out. That is to say, a decision of importance for history for the next 100 years. Always endeavoring to limit the scope of the war, I decided to do something which was difficult for me to do. In 1939, I sent my minister to Moscow. I'm assuming he's talking about Joachim von Ribbentrop, the foreign minister. That meant the most bitter triumph over my feelings. I tried to come to an understanding. You yourselves know best how honestly we observed our obligations. Neither in our press nor at our meetings was a single word about Russia mentioned, not a single word about Bolshevism. Unfortunately, the other side did not observe their obligations from the beginning. This arrangement resulted in a betrayal, which at first liquidated the whole northeast of Europe. You know best what it meant for us to look on in silence as the Finnish people were being strangled, what it meant to us that the Baltic states were also being overpowered. What that meant can be judged by those who know German history and know that there is not a single square kilometer there of land which has not been opened up to culture and civilization by German pioneer work. Yet I remain silent. I took a decision only when I saw that Russia had reached the hour to advance against us at a moment when we had barely three divisions in East Prussia, when 22 Soviet divisions were assembled there. We gradually received proof that on our frontiers, one air base after another was being set up, and one division after another from the gigantic Soviet army was being assembled there. I was then obliged to become anxious, for there is no excuse in history for negligence. I am responsible for the present of the German people, and as far as possible, for its future. I was therefore compelled slowly to take on defensive measures. But in August and September of last year, one thing was becoming clear. A decision in the West with England, which would have contained the whole German Luftwaffe, was no longer possible. For in my rear there stood a state which was getting ready to proceed against me at such a moment, but it is now, only now, that we realize how far the preparation had advanced. I wanted once again to clarify the whole problem, and therefore I invited Molotov, that's the Russian foreign commissar, to Berlin.
Now, when he talks about a decision in the West with England, he's admitting that he had to come, that if it wasn't for his having to strike Russia, right, that he probably would have ended up striking England, to forcing a peace with England.
Yes.
And that, basically, if Hitler had taken England before he had to strike on Russia, if he'd have been able to take England twice as quickly as he took France,
mm-hmm.
and I'm sure that if he didn't have to fight Russia, he probably would have. That would have neutralized America. America wouldn't have had any chance at the forward bases that it needed to launch an effective war on Germany.
Unless they hit Portugal, when Hitler was greatly concerned.
Well, right, but they would have had to fight over the Pyrenees.
Hitler was concerned that in 43-44, that he thought that despite Portugal being neutral, that the Americans would just land in Portugal anyway. So he actually had several German divisions that were ready to be deployed to Portugal.
Well, right, but even if America landed armies in Portugal, they would have had to fight over the Pyrenees, and that's no mean task.
Sure. Also, they could have used Ireland as a base to jump into Britain, but the war would have gone on probably for 3 or 4 more years at least, and there's no guarantee.
Well, not if Hitler has the British Navy at his disposal. That wasn't going to be too easy either.
They probably would have tried to sail to Canada. I'm sure Churchill would have established a government in exile, and Churchill would have fought to the last goyim, wouldn't he?
Well, it would have been a very different war.
Well,
if Hitler could have had 3 or 4 months with Britain before he had to strike on Russia, it would have been a very different war. I'm certain.
I think he shouldn't have let them go at Dunkirk.
No, he shouldn't have. No, he should have bagged the whole lot of them.
Should have sent them to the Eastern Front.
They repaid his kindness with a dagger in the back.
Yes, they did. Yeah, well, yes, because the Jews are ruthless. That they don't. That they see kindness as weakness, as Hitler just said himself. Kindness is weakness.
Absolutely.
That's the law of the jungle.
He could have shown charity to the British by keeping them in nice prison conditions, but in Germany. You don't let them go back to Britain so they can fight against you tomorrow. You capture them all, and instead of massacring them, which the Bolsheviks would do, or putting them in starvation camps, which the Japanese or the Americans might do, you put them in nice accommodations and show them that, you know, here's how Germans treat people.
Well, Hitler was not interested in invading England anyway. He was really not interested in it.
Well, right, but right here he actually makes a confession that if he hadn't have struck Russia, he would have had to force a decision with Britain. And we know he wanted peace. We know he didn't want to invade Britain.
He knew militarily it had to be done.
Well, right, militarily he would have had to. To either force a peace or force a conquest.
All right. He put to me the 4 well-known conditions. First, Germany should finally agree that as Russia felt herself again endangered by Finland, Russia should be able to liquidate Finland. This was the first question, which I found difficult to answer, but I could not do otherwise than refuse this. The second question concerned Romania. A question whether a German guarantee would protect Romania against Russia. In other words, the Soviets want to know, can we invade Romania? Here, too, I stand by my word. I do not regret it, for I have found in General Antonescu a man of honor who at the time blindly stood by his word. The third question referred to Bulgaria. Molotov demanded that Russia should retain the right to send garrisons to Bulgaria and thus give a Russian guarantee to Bulgarian independence. What this means, we know from Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. If the Russians are sending garrisons to your country and giving a guarantee of your independence, what they mean is they have exclusive rights to dominate you. They're guaranteeing that no outside power will dominate you, since you're now a Soviet republic.
Absolutely.
It's like the Mafia Don, who says that he's protecting your shop, and if anybody else tries to collect money from you, you should come to him. He's the only one who can rob you.
Right. And as we'll see in a very quickly here, very briefly here, that's exactly the way they operated, too.
In this question, I said that such a guarantee was conditioned by the wishes of the country whose guarantee was to be given, and that I did not know anything about it, and that I would have to make inquiries and to consult with my allies. The fourth question referred to the Dardanelles. Russia demanded bases on the Dardanelles. If Molotov is now trying to deny this, that is not surprising. If tomorrow or the day after he is no longer in Moscow, he will deny that he is no longer in Moscow. He made this demand, and I rejected it. I had to reject it. This made things clear to me, and further talks were without result. My precautions were called for. After that, I carefully watched Russia. Each division we could observe was carefully noted, and countermeasures were taken.
Now, right here, I would like to interrupt you for a long spell, right? I would like to get into Viktor Suvorov's book, The Chief Culprit, and talk about, and I would like to read his chapter, Mobilization. And it doesn't talk about the actual placing of forces along the border. What it talks about is, first, it contrasts Stalin's tactics to Hitler's, and then it proceeds by telling us about how far advanced this was planned by Stalin, that he was going to strike Germany. And Suvorov basically uses he uses the circumstances in Russia to prove that Stalin planned this. Well, he moved forward with this plan in September of 1939, 2 years and 2 years before Hitler had to strike Russia. Stalin knew this was going to happen. Stalin had to have a war by September of 1941, and it was an absolute necessity, and he got it, and he maneuvered Hitler into it. And I think that Suvorov gives Stalin too much credit, because I really think that it's the Bolshevik, and it's the Jewish bankers who are controlling Bolshevism, but this definitely shows that the USSR planned this war and this conquest of Europe long in advance. This was nothing that happened in 1941. I'd like to read these. It's about five pages.
All right.
This is from Viktor Suvorov, The Chief Culprit, Chapter 20, Mobilization. And he starts out, from time to time, we find a lot of interesting materials in the archives, but we will not find what is important. Here is why. Quote, and now he's quoting Stalin. How many times have I told you, do whatever you want, but do not leave behind any documents. Do not leave any traces. These are the words of Stalin himself. He uttered them publicly at the 16th Congress of the Communist Party. The records here note that the, quote, Homeric laughter of the entire audience, unquote. The Congress laughed heartily. Comrade Stalin made a joke. I guess it was laugh or go to the guillotine, right? Understandably, Stalin was not talking of himself but of his opponents, who apparently were guided by the principle of leaving behind no traces or documents. But the Congress laughed in vain. Stalin always ascribed his own intentions, principles, and methods to his enemies. That's where we talk about the Jews and their willingness and their habit, their tendency to project their own thoughts onto their foes, right?
The Kaiser's planning to kill millions of Jews when really the Jews are planning to kill millions of Germans.
Well, exactly, and this is a serious trait of the Jews. Soon after, Stalin executed all his enemies, as well as almost all the delegates present at the 16th Congress who had laughed so heartily. He left a very minimal number of documents about these executions. Not a single dictator can match Stalin in his ability to cover up traces of his personal involvement in crimes. Anastas Mikoyan, who beat all records of political survival, tells us how well Stalin kept secrets. McCoyan was a member of the Central Committee of the Communist Party from 1923 until 1976. That is for 53 years. For 40 of those years, of which he was a candidate or a member of the Politburo, the most important power organ of the country, which governed the entire Soviet Union and its satellites. McCoyan describes a meeting held by Stalin. Quote, "Most often there were five people. We met in the late evening or at night, rarely in the afternoon, usually without preliminary notice. There were no protocols or records kept during the course of such meetings. Air Force Colonel General A.S. Yakovlev said, quote, "During the meetings of Stalin's inner circle, there were no stenographers, no secretaries present, no records or protocols were kept." Marshal of the Soviet Union, D.F. Ustinov, was the People's Commissar of Arms during the course of the war. During the meetings and conferences conducted by Stalin, the discussions of problems and the making of decisions frequently occurred without records, and often without the corresponding paperwork marking the decision made. In other words, decisions were made but were not fixed on paper, just like in the mafia. Now, of course, Suvorov's a Russian historian telling us all this, right?
I would want everything written down, though, if I were the head of state.
Marshall, well it was a crime family. It was a crime family. They were the mafia.
The Jewish mafia running Russia.
Absolutely. They may as well have been on the Lower East Side, on the wharf in Hoboken, New Jersey.
The kosher Nostra.
Well, or in Washington today.
Yeah, right, or in Washington today with Rahm Emanuel and the rest of those frauds. Marshal of the Soviet Union, G.K. Zhukov, during the course of the war was deputy to the commander-in-chief, that is to Stalin. Quote, "Many political, military, and general government questions were discussed and solved, not only at the official meetings of the Politburo and in the Central Committee Secretariat, but also in the evening at dinner in Stalin's apartment or at his dacha, where the Politburo members closest to him were usually present." Colonel General B. Vanikov was the People's Commissar of Ammunition. He says, quote, "At the meetings and conferences, Stalin had a habit of discussing questions and making decisions without protocols or records."
So, I wonder how many munition strikes there were in the Soviet Union during the war.
Well, right. So from this, it is clear that the understanding of many events just based on documents is incomplete and unclear, and in many cases incorrect. Now, here's some contrast that Suvorov, it's not important to the story, but Suvorov added it in, I think, to show us how noble the Germans were by comparison, right? Hitler's meetings were known for being held in the presence of large crowds. Everything said by Hitler was fixed for history, like the final solution, right? By three stenographers and a personal historian. Stalin's meetings, on the other hand, were simply secret gatherings of plotters and conspirators in spirit and in essence. No documents and no traces were left of these meetings. Therefore, as Stalin taught us, we will look not at the words which are hidden from us, but at the actions which are in the open. It is possible that World War II could not have occurred. The choice was up to Stalin. That this is where I think that he was giving Stalin too much credit. This is only one place, right? There are many examples, but that's okay. The choice was up to Stalin. He himself told this to his colleagues at the Politburo meeting on August 19, 1939. "If we make a pact of mutual aid with Great Britain and France, Germany will give up Poland and the war will be averted." Stalin did not make a pact with Great Britain and France. Thereby, he did not try to avert a war. This day, August 19th, 1939, in other words, the Jews keep your enemies close and your friends closer, right? Well, your friends close and your enemies closer. Stalin's claiming that he purposely made this non-aggression pact with Germany in order that he could destroy Germany later. Stalin did not make a pact with Great Britain and France. Thereby, he did not try to avert a war. This day, August 19th, 1939, was a long, difficult day. This was a day filled with hopes and worries. This was the day when Stalin cast his fishing rod into the brown swamp that was Hitler's Germany. His hook had bait for Hitler, Danzig and half of Poland. Take it and as a free gift, Germany got war against Great Britain and France. This was the day when doubts crawled into the hearts of Stalin's colleagues. Stalin had decided to trick Hitler. Would Hitler believe him? Stalin could not possibly always win. Vyacheslav Molotov worked on the scene as the head of the Soviet government and the People's Correspondent of Foreign Affairs. When Molotov received the German ambassador, von der Schulenburg, in his cabinet in the Kremlin, Stalin, Shaposhnikov, Beria, and Malenkov did not show themselves. They were behind the curtains in Stalin's cabinet.
Well, question, what year was this if the minister wasn't Ribbentrop? Is this a Weimar meeting?
Well, this is 1939.
Oh, okay.
Molotov's conversation with the German ambassador was transmitted to Stalin's office. Molotov worked brilliantly. The most important thing was not to let the ambassador see Stalin's interest in the issue of German-Polish relations. He's going to address the Ribbentrop thing in a moment. Molotov did not reveal his interest. His attitude to the ambassador was, quote, "All right, let Ribbentrop come. Perhaps we will agree on something. Perhaps we will find a solution to the question of Danzig and Poland." So this is a preliminary meeting before the Ribbentrop meetings, right? After the meeting, Schulenburg went to the German embassy to write a report while a heated discussion of the outcomes of the meeting was underway in Stalin's cabinet. The German ambassador had barely reached the embassy when he received a call from the Kremlin. "Molotov awaits you for a new meeting." This was a difficult day, and it ended in Stalin's victory. At dawn on September 1st, 1939, the German army began war against Poland, but in the 20th century, a war in Europe automatically meant a world war. The war quickly engulfed all of Europe and practically the entire world. In a strange coincidence of events, it was precisely on this day, September 1st, 1939, that the fourth emergency session of the Supreme Soviet of the USSR ratified the Universal Military Draft. There had been no such law in the history of the USSR. A surprising thing, while children and adults were taught to fear Hitler, while Hitler was considered to be a tyrant and a monster, the country could do without a draft. But as soon as a non-aggression pact was signed, a universal draft all of a sudden became necessary. Why did the Soviet Union need it? Soviet historians stated that the USSR took measures of precaution. Well, the hypocrisy of the court historians, right? Took measures of precaution. Marshal of the Soviet Union, K.A. Moretzkov, is one of the many of those who assert that the law had a huge significance and was adopted, quote, "in the conditions when World War II had already begun." In other words, the war started. That's why they're gearing up. They know that this war began between Germany and the USSR on September 1st, 1939. It wasn't Germany feigning to be the Soviet Union's ally, as we were taught as children in school. It was the Soviet Union feigning to be Germany's ally. Let us imagine the Polish-German border on that tragic morning. Darkness, fog, fire, motors roaring. Very few people in Poland understood what was happening. Whether this was a provocation or an unsanctioned border war, border conflict that arose on its own. But the representatives at the USSR Supreme Soviet already knew that this was no provocation, no conflict, and no German-Polish or even European war. This was the beginning of a world war. They knew that they, the representatives, must meet in Moscow and take corresponding measures. Why did these representatives not act so efficiently when a similar thing happened on the Soviet-German border in 1941? On the morning of September 1st, 1939, it was not only the Polish government and the governments of the Western countries that did not know that World War II had started. Hitler himself did not know it either. He started the war against Poland, hoping that it would be a local fight like the taking of Czechoslovakia. As Colonel General of the Air Force, A.S. Yakovlev, at that time an aircraft designer, Deputy People's Commissar of Aviation Industry and personal advisor to Stalin, concluded, quote, "Hitler was sure that England and France would not fight for Poland. when on September 3rd, Great Britain and France declared war on Germany. This was extremely shocking and unpleasant for Hitler. Now this reading this is a surprise to me, right? He had not anticipated this. For him, a strange war against Great Britain and France began on September 3rd. In the same month, an equally strange peace began in the East. Any attempt to establish the exact date of the beginning of World War II and the time that the USSR entered into it brings us to the date of August 19th, 1939. Stalin stretched the hand of friendship out to Hitler and signed the Non-Aggression Pact, while on the same day he issued an order to gather the representatives of the Supreme Soviet so that at the time World War II began, they were already sitting in the Kremlin and unanimously voting in favor of everything put before them, and including the universal draft, right? What a strange coincidence. The road to Moscow is long. For some, it takes 10 to 12 days. In order to adopt the law on September 1st, 1939, the order to gather the representatives was issued on August 19th, meaning that on August 19th, 1939, someone in Moscow already knew that in a couple of weeks, World War II would begin and a new draft law would be needed. The chief of General Staff and Marshal of the Soviet Union, B.M. Shaposhnikov, created a theory of mobilization. He authored the book Brain of the Army. The third and final volume was published in 1929, and while the Soviet Army existed, the book served as a manual for every Soviet officer and general. On Lenin's desk, a copy of the book Mob Psychology by Gustav Le Bon had always been present, and on Stalin's desk, it was Shaposhnikov's Brain of the Army. The key to the success of Shaposhnikov's book, was in the simplicity with which the material was presented, in the crystal clear argumentation, and in the ability to explain the most complex problems in terms understandable by everybody. The third concluding part of the book is most powerful. In the third volume, Shaposhnikov examines the questions of mobilization. The theory was simple, understandable, logical, and unquestionably correct. Stalin understood it, appraised its worth, and added it to the base of his own strategy. This is why reading Shaposhnikov's works, as well as those of his supporters and opponents, and understanding the course of their thought, helps us understand Stalin's actions, which at first glance seem illogical and unexplainable. The theory of mobilization, condensed and explained in layman's terms, consists of the following. And I'm probably going to abbreviate these, right? There's 7 points here. One, to achieve victory in war, not only efforts of the entire army, but efforts by the entire nation, the people, the industry, transport, agriculture, etc., are necessary. Two, the nation cannot exist in a constant state of preparedness for war, just as man cannot constantly hold a gun in each hand. If he is always holding two guns, he cannot do anything else. The idea there is that this state of war that the nation is prepared for can't last forever, or the nation will fall lax, right? Three, mobilization is the transition of the entire country from a peacetime to a wartime regime. Mobilization cannot be curbed or turned back. Four, mobilization and war are inseparable. If you take out a gun and aim it at the enemy with your finger on the trigger, you have to shoot. Five, you cannot play games with mobilization. If you brandish guns and aim them at your neighbors with your fingers on the trigger, the outcome will not be a good one for you. In other words, if you're going to pull the gun, you better use it.
Sure, and if you pull a gun on police, they're going to assume you're going to use it. They're not going to ask you what your intentions are.
Well, exactly. So if you're going to pull a gun, you better use it. Six, once the path of mobilization has been chosen, you have to follow it up to the end. Start a war. In other words, if you're mobilizing your troops, you start a war. And by doing this, by laying this out, Suvorov is proving that Stalin, whose theory on mobilization is the same as this that this soldiers, Shaposhnikov is a professional soldier, right? And Stalin adopted his theories on mobilization, that as soon as that draft command went, that meant that Stalin had been planning war as soon as that law was passed, September 1st, 1939, 2 weeks before that, 2 weeks before Hitler rolled into Poland, Stalin was already planning a war with Germany. There's no doubt in Suvorov's mind, and this lays out a damn good case for it. This proves it. And these ideas, in various orders and manners, are voiced by many different authors. B.M. Shaposhnikov differed from his predecessors only in that he expressed the ideas clearly, briefly, and concisely, so a criminal like Stalin could understand it, right? Mobilization is not only a symptom of war, it is war itself. An order by the government to declare mobilization constitutes a de facto declaration of war. In modern conditions, a mobilizing country must make a firm decision ahead of time to conduct war. In general, in a general mobilization, it is understood that there can be no more return to peacetime positions. And the United States, we've been mobilized for war here in this country for 100 years now, right?
Well, what is it, the war on poverty, the war on crime, the war on terrorism, the war on drugs, the war on all these...
Right, and Shaposhnikov realized that you can't keep a country in a constant state of mobilization. Why? You drain its resources. You destroy the nation. You gut its infrastructure. And that's exactly what's happened in this country. We maintain that only a general mobilization has value, the concentration of all resources and forces necessary for achieving victory. The book ends, meaning Shaposhnikov's book, with a decisive declaration, quote, mobilization is war. We cannot understand it in any other way. So Suvorov proves that Stalin planned this war 2 weeks before Hitler ever rolled into Poland. Stalin knew he was going to war with Germany. And Hitler was only basically deceived by any non-aggression pact with the Soviet Union. Now, I'd like to say in Hitler's defense that he had his own reasons, but he probably could not have known that this war was already... I think it was decided in 1933. It was decided.
Absolutely.
And
the
Jews of London knew damn well in 1933 that they were going to organize the Soviet Union, the United States, France, and Britain to destroy Germany.
That's why the Soviet Union all of a sudden in 1940 had 10,000 tanks to put against the Germans.
Right, and that's exactly what Suvorov, this doesn't get into tanks and munitions, but we're going to see it does get into this draft law, this law that created this universal draft that was passed on the day that Hitler's tanks rolled across the Polish border. Stalin not only shared Shaposhnikov's views, but he had the same beliefs. Stalin did not make any distinctions between the process of taking power in his country or in the neighboring ones. He knew how to take power in his own country, and he planned to do the same in the neighboring ones. Stalin did not keep his art a secret. On the contrary, he made it into a display for the masses. In his book, On the Foundations of Leninism, Stalin proved that games are not permissible in the quest for power. We either take control or we do not. Once the task is attempted, it must be carried out to the end. This goes along with the teachings of Niccolo Machiavelli. Either you deliver a lethal blow or you do not attack at all. No in-between decisions can exist in politics or in strategy. This goes along with Shaposhnikov's ideas. We can either not mobilize at all or we can conduct a full-scale mobilization and enter the war. No partial in-between positions can be adopted. There was another problem. Mobilization had to be concealed. Long before World War II, Stalin and Shaposhnikov worked out a plan to conceal mobilization. For this reason, there was no universal military draft in the Soviet Union until 1939. The army was very selective and did not take in just anybody. This was to show what a peace-loving people we were. The age requirement for entering the armed services was 21. This is strange. Why not draft at 18 or 19, right out of school, let the boy serve his term, and be free? By age 21, a man could have found a job and started a family, while his future remained uncertain. Would they draft him or not? Nobody could really explain why the Army had to take men at age 21 and not younger. There was, however, a lot of thought put into this system. It was like a dam on a river. Not everyone was let through, that means that is drafted, only some, while the rest amassed on the other side. At the necessary moment, a universal draft could be instituted. Only the pretext had to be invented, and all those who did not serve earlier in the Army could be called in. During the intervening years, there were many of them saved up. The moment came, September 1st, 1939. On this day, a universal military draft was instituted, and all those who had not served earlier began to be taken in. In every separate case, the calling of a mature man to the Army did not raise the suspicion that a big war was looming. Every man must serve his country, so this or that Ivan had to do now what his friends did before. Stalin had another tactic in reserve. According to the new law, the draft age was reduced from 21 to 19, and in some categories to 18. My own father, meaning Suvorov, was among this group. He had just turned 18 at the time. The simultaneous draft of three age groups, never before seen, and the draft of all those who had not served earlier, placed a double burden on the shoulders of the nation. On the one hand, the economy was deprived of all these workers. On the other hand, they all had to be clothed, fed, equipped, and housed somewhere, try to find a place for at least 1 million new soldiers. This was an explosive development of military might. After 173,000 reservists were drafted in the second half of July 1939 to support the troops of the Transbaikal Military District and the 1st Army Group in Mongolia, the Red Army, without the Navy, interior troops, or border guards, numbered 1,871,600 men. By June 22nd of 1941, which is not even 2 years, the Red Army, again without the Navy, interior troops, or border guards, numbered 5,081,000 men. That's almost triple, right? The law adopted on September 1st, 1939, allowed for an increase in the ranks of the Red Army from 1.5 million men in the spring of 1939 to 5.7 million men in the spring of 1941 without declaring mobilization and alarming the neighbors. Additionally, this law allowed for the preparation of 18 million reservists so that at any moment they could fill the ranks with the desired number of soldiers. This army development had a time limit because Stalin called several age groups into the Red Army at the same time. In essence, all the young men in the country. The duration of army service for the majority of the population, privates in the ground forces, and NKVD, political police forces, was 2 years. So the country had to enter a major war before September 1st, 1941. If not, all the young people would go home on September 1st, 1941, and then there would be almost nobody left to draft. All these new armies, assaults and mechanized corps, tanks, Air Force, and all other divisions would have to be disbanded. It is impossible to maintain an armed force of this size without a war. It does not produce anything, and it consumes everything produced by the country. The creation of such an army could only lead to war. The modern Russian Ministry of Defense acknowledges this. Quote, no nation can maintain a mobilized army with any intent other than war. The economy cannot stand the strain, and the mobilized but unused army begins to decay. This was said about the mobilization conducted by Stalin starting on August 19, 1939, when he made the decision to launch a secret mobilization. Stalin firmly knew that in 2 years, in the summer of 1941, the Soviet Union must enter into a large war. Without war, no terror could suffice to keep 5 million soldiers who had already served their 2 required years in the barracks. It would be impossible to retain them in the Army after their terms in the Army expired. To put it more simply, the decision to enter a large war was made in the Kremlin in August of 1939, and the deadline for entering the war was set the summer of 1941. So that basically proves that this was planned by the Soviets at least 2 years in advance, and it was carefully planned.
Absolutely. There can be no doubt. They were playing the war years in advance, and they knew America was coming into the war soon enough, too, didn't they?
I think they knew it all. I think they knew that America would come to aid on the Western Front. Otherwise, the Soviets were taking a huge risk. And a risk they almost lost anyway.
And they would have lost had it not been for the United States.
Well, I believe so, because Britain was basically prostrate without American help. I think Britain would have had a real hard time with probably if Hitler didn't let those people go at Dunkirk and had sent 300,000 of his own troops across the channel. I think Britain was dead.
Well, they couldn't have survived. There's no way they could contest Germany on the continent, so they had to use their navy only, and even that's not gonna do them enough. They couldn't win a war like that.
Well, absolutely. And I think that if America definitely, well, we bailed out the Soviets from the late 1930s, right, with all the trucks and tanks we were sending over there from 1939. And the Lend-Lease Act sealed that. And that's what we entered the war before the Lend-Lease Act. In reality.
The Lend-Lease Act was basically, I think, a way to enslave Americans, since they took our productivity and they gave it away to the Jewish Bolsheviks in the Soviet Union. So they put us to work for the Soviets.
Well, they were probably the only jobs in America at the time for most people.
Building tanks for the Soviet Union.
And I'm sure most of us just loved it. That's what happens when you sign a deal with Satan and give him control of your household funds, right? That's exactly what we did in 1913. And we were rewarded with World War I, the Depression, World War II, and the 60s. That's our reward. This is our reward. Obama's our reward for signing a deal with the devil. Oh, okay, I thought that was a good place to cover that in this speech, because it proves beyond all doubt that Hitler was right, that he had to strike Russia, that Russia had planned this long in advance, and Hitler said that he was watching them. Well, he was watching them put this army together is what he was watching.
All right. The position in May had so far advanced that I could no longer dismiss the thought of a life and death conflict. At that time, I had always to remain silent, and that was doubly difficult for me, perhaps not so difficult with regards to the German people, for they had to realize there are moments when one cannot talk if one does not wish to endanger the whole nation. More difficult was silence for me with regard to my soldiers who, division by division, stood on the eastern frontier of the Reich and yet did not know what was actually going on, and it was just on account of them I could not speak. Had I dropped one single word, I would have not changed Stalin's decision, but the possibility of surprise, which remained for me as a last weapon, would then not have existed. And had that been the case, had Hitler said to Stalin, if you try anything, we're going to wipe you out, he would have been telling Stalin the jig is up, and Stalin would have known then.
Right, exactly.
So he had to just bide his time and get his military ready.
And hope to catch Stalin off guard, which he did.
Absolutely. Any such indication, any such hint, would have cost the lives of hundreds of thousands of our comrades. I was therefore silent until the moment when I finally decided to take the first step myself. When I see the enemy leveling his rifle at me, I am not going to wait until he presses the trigger. I would rather be the first to press the trigger. This was the most difficult decision of my whole life, for every such step opened up the gate behind which secrets are hidden so that posterity will know how it came about and how it happened. Thus, one can only rely on one's conscience, the confidence of one's people, one's own weapons, and what one asks of the Almighty. Not that he supports inaction, but he blesses him who is himself ready and willing to fight and make sacrifices for his existence. On June 22nd in the morning, the greatest battle in the history of the world started. Since then, something like 3.5 months have elapsed, and here I say this. Everything since then has proceeded according to plan. During the whole period, the initiative has not been taken even for a second out of the hand of our leadership. Up to the present day, every action has developed just as much according to plan as formerly in the East against Poland, and then again against the West, and finally against the Balkans. But I must say one thing at this point. We have not been wrong in our plans. We have also not been mistaken about the efficiency and bravery of the German soldier, nor have we been mistaken about the quality of our weapons. And incidentally, I'd say that the Germans were vastly superior soldier for soldier if you look at the Soviets, certainly. And then, of course, the Americans. The Americans had an overwhelming firepower, artillery, air support advantage that they used to their benefit. But man for man, the German soldiers were better. Wouldn't you agree, Bill and Kaiser?
Well, absolutely. They were better trained. They were in better shape, and they were better equipped.
For the most part, yeah. But it took time for the Western and the Russian soldiers to learn the trade.
And I would definitely think that the German soldiers were better motivated.
And the German soldiers had tactical superiority, I think, throughout the war. Their officers, they were better at taking the initiative. They were more creative. They were clever. The Americans might have had more soldiers that on an individual level had better accuracy, since the Americans had a shooting culture and a hunting culture. I doubt many Soviet soldiers had opportunities to hone their marksmanship in the 20s and 30s as civilians. They'd been found with a gun in the 20s or 30s, they'd have wound up in a gulag.
Well, absolutely, but the Soviets, you know, that Eastern mentality, you just throw massive amounts of manpower at something, right?
Well, if you need a company, why not send a division?
Well, what do you do with a rifle when there's 100 million Chinamen chasing you down with hoes and pitchforks?
Absolutely. We have not been mistaken about the smooth working of the whole organization at the front and extending over a gigantic area in the rear. Neither have we been mistaken about the German homeland. We have, however, been mistaken about one thing. We had no idea how gigantic the preparations of this enemy were against Germany and Europe, and how immeasurably great was the danger, how by the skin of our teeth we have escaped the destruction not only of Germany, but also of Europe. That I can say now. I say it only today because I can say that this enemy is already broken and will never rise again. Well, had it not been for the United States, that army, the Red Army, would have been broken and never risen again. But the U.S. gave it new life. Her power
well,
had... Sorry, go on.
No, go on. I was just going to say, there's no doubt. Go on.
All right. Her power had been assembled against Europe, of which, unfortunately, most had no idea, and many even today have no idea. And we could say many today still have no idea. This would have been a second storm of Genghis Khan. That this danger was averted, we owe in the first place to the bravery, endurance, and sacrifice of the German soldiers, and also the sacrifice of those who marched with us. For the first time, something like a European awakening passed through this continent. In the north, Finland is fighting, a true nation of heroes, for in her wide spaces she relies on her own strength, her bravery, and tenacity. In the south, Romania is fighting. It has recuperated with astonishing speed from one of the most difficult crises that may befall a country, and the people are led by a man at once brave and quick at making decisions. He's referring to General Antonescu, by the way. This embraces the whole width of this battlefield from the Arctic Ocean to the Black Sea. Our German soldiers are now fighting in these areas, and with them in their ranks, Finns, Italians, Hungarians, Romanians, Slovaks, Croats, and Spaniards are now going into battle. Belgians, Netherlanders, Danes, Norwegians, and even Frenchmen have joined.
And the Waffen SS is really not spoken about at all, I don't think, in mainstream American circles,
well,
in mainstream Western circles. John, I don't know, you might know better than me, but how often do you hear about the Waffen SS in mainstream books that you'd pick up off a shelf? or in the history book club.
You only hear about the SS as being a purely German origin.
Well, right, and that many foreign nations fought on the side of Germans is basically an embarrassment to the establishment.
Absolutely.
Right.
Or you hear about the SS, but it's in regards to, oh, they killed the Jews, they did this, they did that, they were horrible butchers and monsters, evil, nasty, vile people.
Well, I mean, the Spain sent the Spanish Blue Division there, and they were a crack unit.
But the Westerners pressured Franco and threatened him, and he had to recall that unit, I believe in 43, was it, or 44.
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
No, I was just making a statement that the West basically forced Franco to recall that division.
I think they fought up until at least 44, but I could be wrong about that.
Because Franco was concerned that the Western Allies might invade Spain, and Hitler was concerned they were going to invade Portugal. And if you want, I could read the numbers and names of the almost 40 Waffen-SS divisions, if you want me to do that, or should we save that for another time?
Yes, we'll save that for another time.
Okay, I just want to point out that they had some divisions of Indian soldiers that they'd captured in North Africa fighting the British and the Indians. Thousands of them joined and served in various support roles. They had an entire Italian division, several divisions of Cossacks. I think they had one division from Estonia, one from Latvia. They had a Croatian division, some from Romania. They had, of course, a Norwegian division, and they had a lot of Frenchmen and Netherlanders. And that's something that we don't often hear about. So if the Germans hated all these people and wanted to kill everybody that wasn't German, why would all these people join their war effort?
Well, yeah. They even had Russian units.
Absolutely. The Vlasov army.
Well,
and
That was actually, Hitler put the kibosh on that, but it was ready to go.
Absolutely. And they actually did have several divisions of Russian soldiers, and they had a lot of Russian helpers helping out as auxiliaries. And you can read on Worthless Jew Wikipedia here, they claim that Hitler and Himmler were going to kill 80% of the population of England when they finally took over, since they considered England to be mostly racially inferior. And they were forming special SS groups to kill 8 out of 10 British people, and the rest would be sent to Germany to be enslaved and worked to death in mines.
Yeah, that's just laughable.
This sounds to me like a Jewish fantasy for the United States. Kill 80% of us, take the women to Israel, and then work the men to death in mines.
Well, it sounds like a Jewish dream.
It's, again, they're projecting what they've done and what they want to do. If Hitler hated the Easterners, ask yourself, who massacred the Polish officers? Did the Germans massacre any Poles, or was that the NKVD?
No records that I can that I know of.
I mean, I can't see any evidence of German mistreatment of Polish prisoners, but the Soviets massacred plenty. But in 30 or 40 more years, the history books will say 200,000 Polish officers, 80% of whom were Jews because they were so patriotic and loved Poland and wanted to serve, were massacred by the Germans after Poland was overrun. All right.
Well, we should probably take this opportunity to break this and pick it up here next week, no?
All right.
We're not going to get this finished tonight.
All right, if you want to pick it up next week, we will be here at 8 p.m. at the same time. Thank you. Yahweh bless.
Thank you. Praise Yahweh.
Yahweh.